Welcome to Newsworthy with Norisworthy. Get ready for some awesome.
Welcome back to the show, friends. Today we have with us my second favorite psychologist, my second favorite guest named Richard, but my favorite guest who's a psychologist named Richard, Dr. Richard Beck. How are you today?
Glad to be back. Who's your favorite psychologist?
My dad.
Oh, that's true.
The guy who offices right next to you.
That is true.
Yeah, so he's there.
He's one of my favorite psychologists as well.
Really? Yeah. What a coincidence.
You know, he was my first psych teacher. I was when I was a freshman or a sophomore, I took Introduction to Psychology at Northeastern mm-hmm. Christian Junior College, and your dad was a young professor at that time, and I wasn't a psychology major.
But you were a Bible major, weren't you?
I was a Bible major at that time.
Did my dad convert you to psychology?
No.
I'm going to say yes.
I think so. That was the beginning of it all mm-hmm. right there. And so, yeah, he was my very first psychology teacher. So everything I know, I learned
really?
From Larry Norisworthy. Yeah.
Well, that's good. What do you remember him teaching? I imagine him as like the Robin Williams and, you know, Dead Poets Society, like with a big beard, and he's just being kind of like a hippie, standing on a desk. Was that my dad when he was a young professor?
I'm not lying to you when I say this. That is exactly what I was going to say.
No way.
He reminded me a little bit of Robin Williams and Dead Poets Society. He did, you know. That's the thing about your dad. Nobody knows he has that kind of hippie background.
Yeah, you know? Well, I know. Uh-huh.
There was a while there where we both had our guitars up in our offices.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, yeah. So he's a good guitar player.
Yeah, he's good.
Yeah. And so I don't know if he still has it in there, but for a while there, he would be in there and play his guitar in between classes.
Yeah, he is such a hippie. When I mm-hmm. was, so Philadelphia, that's when you were a student. I lived there till I was like 10 or 12 or something like that. And he had a group that would get together every Friday night and they would play. And he had a banjo that was involved.
Oh, really? I didn't know you played the banjo.
And they had a little band, and they called it Jubilee. And that is a source of a lot of my deep-seated brokenness, is having to run to the other side of the house while they're just going to town.
When Jubilee was practicing. That's great. I'll bring that up with him.
Yeah, please do. I still remember him making me listen to Four Men Dead in Ohio. Who is that? That's like some 70s rock song. The song about the shooting in Ohio that happened. It's
the Kent State shooting?
Yeah, the Kent State shooting. There's a song about that.
Oh, is there?
Yeah, you don't really know what I'm talking about.
No,
do you?
No, no.
Someone can Google that and figure me.
Okay.
Figure what I was talking about. Well, speaking of other people that you have a big man crush on, this weekend, I go on Twitter, I go on the internet, and I can't help but seeing this budding bromance between you and Greg Boyd.
That's
right. You're putting a post on your blog about how much you love Greg. Greg is posting, he posted a selfie with you and him in it.
That might be the first selfie of mine, like, ever online. I'm not on Twitter and I'm not on Facebook, so the opportunity for taking selfies is
just never done. Yeah,
yeah, I don't know where to put it.
That was your first one.
I can't recall another selfie.
But
online.
He was tweeting a bunch about you. You have a blog post. I would not have been shocked if I walked in here and you had a necklace, BFF, Beck and Boyd with the heart broken in half.
I am a big fan of Greg Boyd's.
Is that the first time you guys met?
Yes. Uh-huh. It was, I mean, obviously I knew him, and I had some interaction with him online because some of my stuff they've written about on his Renew blog. And, mm-hmm. and so we've had some connections there, and I blogged through his book, God at War.
Mm-hmm.
I think which we might talk about.
We should.
In this podcast. And so we knew of each other, but I've never been in the same venue. I don't speak a great many places, so I don't traffic a lot with the Christian celebrity culture.
But you guys are like the progressive churches, like Jimmy Fallon, Justin Timberlake, you guys together. Pictures you all over the place.
I'll take that. Yeah.
Which one would you rather be, Fallon or Timberlake?
You know, I giggle a lot, so I'll probably Jimmy Fallon. Yeah,
that's a good
choice. I'm a bit of a giggler. That's what my students tell me. I giggle too much during my lectures.
Now, Boyd, he seems like he cries when he preaches. I used to listen to a lot of his podcasts, and I think he cries. So I feel like that's more of a Timberlake thing. Do you think?
Maybe. Does this Justin Timberlake crying right there?
I don't know enough about pop music to really go with that. You're the expert on Lady Gaga. You should know
that's
all
true.
Pop music.
Lady Gaga, boy, her star has kind of fallen. You know, I don't think.
Do you think you need to do some blogging to kind of help
resuscitate?
I need to
resuscitate that blog. Was it The Gospel According to Lady Gaga? That is still like one of my most traffic posts.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I still remember the poster of her, and then like your words are superimposed over top of that.
Yeah, there was a Lady Gaga fan site that had found blog post, and this is a year or two after I had posted it. And yeah, and they had kind of made one of those graphics and had a picture of Lady Gaga looking kind of monstrous and had my quote about welcoming monsters.
Yeah.
And so I found a backlink to it and went to it and said, yeah, so when your theology is leaking into Lady Gaga fan sites, you know you're doing something right, I think.
What do you think the chance – okay, what would happen if you found out that she'd incorporated some of your words into one of her songs?
What would happen?
What would you – like, what would your initial
– I'd be thrilled. I would try to score some tickets or something, you know.
If you did, do you think we could set up a podcast with the three of us?
I think that would be the most interesting theological conversation of all time. Richard Beck, Lady Gaga, and Luke Norsworth.
I'm just the facilitator. Now,
I'll make it happen.
Carrie Underwood wrote a song that she was inspired by Rick Warren's Purpose Driven Life. And so you could be the equivalent of that.
Good. Mm-hmm. All right, let's work on it.
Yeah,
I've always hoped. Sometimes when you post things, you kind of wonder, like,
what's going to happen?
Yeah, what will happen? So I've always wondered, you know, maybe in some far future, Lady Gaga would retweet my post. But it hasn't happened yet, so apparently she's never seen it.
Well, you know what? Let's make this happen. Yeah. We could start a Twitter campaign.
That somebody needs to tweet this at her, you know.
I'll do that. I'll tweet at her.
Yeah.
I'll find her on Twitter, and I'll send her a tweet. I'm sure she'll read it.
Well, let's see. Let's see if it happens. That's the challenge. Will Lady Gaga retweet
this
my post on the Gospel According to Lady Gaga?
Let's make that happen. Now, Greg Boyd seems to believe more in miracles than you or I do, so maybe he should be the one tweeting this.
That's true.
We had
a conversation about that exact topic.
Mm-hmm. What did you get? How did it go?
Well, he was asking me. I was the driver. So we were at the streaming event at Rochester College.
Oh, that's not a metaphor. You literally were driving him around.
Yeah, I was literally driving around.
Is that a psychological term that I'm unfamiliar with?
I had the rental car, and we were at the same hotel, and so I drove him back. You know, we just drove back and forth from the venue every night, and so just gotten. Now, I think that's kind of where we got in all these conversations is afterwards. And so he was asking me what I was doing. Was I writing another book or something like that? And I said, well, if I did write another book, it would be on kind of the stuff that I had written on my blog about a series on weakness and warfare, where I try to interact with his book, God at War, but kind of connect it with a progressive, liberal, theological sensibility. And he wanted to know, like, what that meant. And I said, well, you know, it's trying to recapture, revitalize, or rehabilitate language of spiritual warfare, language of the satanic or the demonic, but for people who have trouble believing in, you know, embodied, personal, spiritual agents. Because in God at War, and if you know Greg Boyd, he believes in, like, a literal personal devil and, you know, real demons. And so he was expressed some kind of not concern, but kind of like, well, what's the big deal? Why don't you believe in?
Yeah. Did you go Walter Wink on him?
And that's what I said. Yeah, I said that I've been, you know, using Walter Wink stuff, and I said that the work I'm trying to do is more bridge building between a viewpoint that he would have, and people who are experiencing disenchantment a little bit. Progressives kind of have a disenchanted world, or they struggle with those kinds of beliefs, and so. So that I'm trying to build a bridge and using Wink's work.
Can you
to do
explain
that
kind of like a brief synopsis of what Wink is saying?
Yeah, I mean, so this is Wink's trilogy on the powers, and Wink's basic idea is that there is a dualism that at work in the ancient mind, that there is a spiritual underside to physical powers, and we have tended to see, the ancients kind of saw that as a above below dichotomy. So the spiritual world was above us, the physical world was below us.
Yeah. Three-tier world stuff.
Yeah, and he said that in our wrestling with the principalities and powers, so like Ephesians, you know, our battle is not against flesh and blood, but against the principalities and powers. You know, a lot of people have unpacked that as political language, and so lots of progressives like the idea that our battle isn't necessarily against the devil, but against the powers.
And when you're saying political, some people are hearing you say, is it like against Republicans or Democrats, or what do you mean by that?
Well, I think that's where Wink's interest is. So lots of people would think about like empire or economics, any sort of power system So almost any institutional power would classify on Wink's definition of the powers. And so you're fighting, so your classic progressive agenda, you're fighting against injustice, systemic injustice. And so my spiritual warfare, my spiritual battle is against systemic political oppression, economic exploitation, injustices. So we're fighting against those systemic powers. And that's a fairly disenchanted view because you're not fighting against a spiritual force, evil or the devil, but you're fighting against, you know, things we can see. We can see political exploitation and injustice. But Wink's argument is that these power systems, these institutional arrangements and economic arrangements do have an animating spirituality that's really hard to pin down. And if you don't like the word spirituality, they have an inner culture, a life way, a value system that isn't necessarily often encoded. So it's encoded in language and in symbols and
give me an traditions. Example of that.
Well, so we talk about if you talk about the mythos of America, like, so what are some of the animating spiritualities of our culture? So you can point to things like the Liberty Bell, and you can go to the Smithsonian Museum and point to flags. You can point to artifacts, but behind those artifacts, there is there's animating values or beliefs. So when we talk about, like, you know, the rugged individualism of America, that's a spirituality. That where is that located? Where is that battle against the rugged individualism? It's not against any sort of physical thing, but it is about something. It's about the air we breathe. Mm-hmm. And so Wink says that's kind of the animating spirit. Or take Christmas. When Christians talk about, you know, the
war current, against Christmas?
No, not the war against Christmas. The animating spirituality, the consumerism of Christmas.
Okay.
So the animating angel or spirituality of Christmas is consumption. And so you see some Christians want to take that back, right? So, yeah, the reason for the season might be a cliche, but you're trying to name that rather than the mall. You're not fighting against the mall. You're not necessarily fighting against Walmart, but you're fighting against kind of a spirituality of Christmas where we're consumptive, and maybe we should maybe give and maybe put our money elsewhere rather than buy more toys or a bigger, wider screen.
Yeah.
And so the idea that I think Wink is trying to say is that when we talk about the powers, the thing you're really fighting against is the inner, what he calls the inner nature. And so to kind of wrap this up, instead of above and below, heaven above us, the spiritual world above us, he sees it, he flips it around and says it's an inner outer. So there's an outer core, the physical things we see, all the shopping at Christmas or the flag waving on the 4th of July. But the spirituality is what's the inner animating ethos of it all. And so therefore our battle against the principalities and powers is actually more about that spiritual core or center. So it is a spiritual battle, and it is a warfare in that sense. But you're obviously, when you're talking about it that way, you're not seeing that spirituality as actually like a demon with a name and an agency like a human mind.
So when Boyd is hearing you say this, as someone who doesn't ascribe to that opinion, doesn't have that same worldview, is he going, are you even a Christian or what? How does he respond to that?
Well, I think his argument is like, just why don't you believe? I think he thinks that it's fairly amply attested to, at least in his own experience. And so I think he finds it unbelievable that people don't believe, which I find somewhat unbelievable.
Okay, you know, there's a lot of unbelievers right there.
Right, so he finds it somewhat unbelievable that people struggle with that belief, because he seems like it's
so he probably comes from a more charismatic background, I'm assuming.
I'm not trying to recall. I think he might have said that he came from a charismatic background.
Not that charismatics aren't well educated, but he comes, I think he has a PhD from Yale or some Ivy League school.
I mean, he's a really smart guy.
And so he has an experience with, you know, more of a charismatic, you know, perspective on spirituality. And so he thinks, well, everyone should have this because he's had it.
I think so. Well, so he asked me, like, why don't you believe in those things? And it's not necessarily that I want to put a stake down and say I don't believe in those things. It's just that I find the need to have a little bit richer understanding of what that might be. I don't want my my view of spiritual order to hinge upon whether or not I don't want to put a lot of weight on whether or not I believe in, you know, literal demons or not. Like, I don't want to put that much weight on my, in my faith walk upon whether
what
or not.
What do you mean don't
right
put weight on it?
Well, that I couldn't be a Christian if I didn't believe that. You know, to me, it's a peripheral issue there. And so I said, so he goes, but then he pushed, and I think this is a legitimate question. He said,
he pushed you?
Well, you
know, he's a pacifist.
He pushed me rhetorically.
Oh, okay. I was like, how can two pacifists get in a fight?
Yeah, exactly.
It's like a Canadian traffic jam. You go first. No, you go first.
Yeah.
So he metaphorically
pushed
you.
Well, so, yeah, well, you believe in God, so why not the devil, you know? And I said, well, I feel like I have had experiences of God. It's not a mental construct to me. It's not a propositional belief. Like, I feel like there are things in my experiences that I have named as God and I understand, and there are deep, deep things, the most fundamental things that I've experienced. So that's kind of my tether to faith, are those primal experiences of feeling like I'm not alone in the universe, or there's something more to all of this. So I can point to those experiences, even if they're hard to articulate. Yeah. I said, but I've been around pretty extreme variants of human behavior. Like, I've worked 4 years in a psychiatric hospital, so I've seen some crazy stuff.
Yeah.
But I said, I've not yet seen anything that made me go, that's a demon.
So
that's the devil.
Okay,
and so I said, so I, lacking that experience, I see that as a different thing than saying I believe in God. I just haven't had experience with it. And I think he has. Mm-hmm. We talked a little bit about that, and that's his story to tell. Mm-hmm. But he's felt like he has encountered, like, legitimate demons in other human beings. And I know many people who have worked in the third world report those kinds of experiences as well. And so that's a different case. So that's why I don't want to be – I'm agnostic about it. I'm not atheistic about the devil. Mm-hmm. I'm agnostic about it. I'm not saying there isn't at some point where I'm going to turn a corner and I'm going to hit something that say, no, I think I encountered personified evil. But before I get to that point in my life, I have to think through what I can experience and explain, and I'm drawn toward more progressive visions of spiritual warfare.
And you're fine if it's there, if it's not there, doesn't really
affect. Again, that's what I'm saying is I like to create a theology that I don't like to put weight on things that I don't think needs a lot of weight. So I'm willing to just let a lot of things go.
You know, I had a conversation with a friend of mine, and 2 years ago, we're in our small group, and she asked me, well, do you believe in the devil? And I go, it seems like there's kind of an evolving understanding of the devil and the Jewish scriptures. And, you know, eventually you get to Jesus, and he's talking to the devil, so it's probably easier to think that Jesus is talking to the devil than just kind of making that up. And so, yeah, but it's not a big deal to me. Well, literally, last week she goes, you know, 2 years ago you said you didn't believe in the devil, and I was like, obviously you believe or remember that a whole lot more than I do. But it was very, you know, earth-shaking for her to hear someone say, especially a preacher, to say, yeah, I don't really believe in the devil, maybe I do, I don't know, it's, I'm fine either way.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think enables you to have that sort of loose grip on certain theological principles?
Boy, that's a big question.
That's why you come on the show.
Yeah.
Answer those. Dr. Richard Beck.
Yeah. You know, I don't know how you get to a point in your life where you kind of begin thinking that there are certain things Jesus would, you know, I know Paul said, right, things of first importance, or Jesus says the greatest commandment. I think at some point when you struggle with doubts a lot, this might be the answer, that you try to whittle down. You try to make belief easier by whittling
just
it down.
Just have a short list.
Yeah, exactly. Just have a short list. Just say, here's the way I've described it. If you have trouble believing in God, well, you know, why add another thing on there, make it heavier, you know? So a lot of progressive Christians, because of disenchantment, like, they're working on belief in God, and faith and doubt are big issues for them. And then you start laying on a really complex, you know, metaphysical overlay, and so you got to believe all of that. So I see it kind of concentrically, that there are some things that are at the middle and you could kind of move out. But there's lots of people that know you have to believe everything equally. And if you believe it, and it's a slippery slope, if you don't believe in this kind of more tangential thing, Because then once you believe in the devil, then you're going to have to start believing in demons and, you know, and then do I have to believe in angels and then, you know, on and on. Now, there's no doubt about, particularly from our faith tradition, that you're going to have to say some things about the biblical witness. You're going to have to understand, and thus the whole point of my trying to understand the language of the satanic and the demonic. So there's residual issues you got to deal with. But those do seem more tangential down the road. We'll work on God and then
start there.
We can get to devils down the road.
So you and Boyd, you might have a disagreement on that, right? Like the actual warfare theology, isn't that the language he uses in his book?
Yeah, he calls it a warfare theology or a theology of revolt. And this is what I really liked about, and this is where I find connection with him, because if there's one thing that I think progressives do resonate with and agree on, is that the problem of evil and suffering is like the biggest issue that we face and have to wrestle with theologically. Because that it often seems like that's usually what causes the first round of faith crises for lots of progressive and liberal Christians. But I think he says something really interesting in God at War, where he basically says is that for lots of us, the problem of suffering and evil has become more of a theological puzzle. How could a good and all-loving and benevolent God let this happen? And he says it just seems like the biblical writers just accept evil and they get on with the business of revolt. Like the only theodicy, you know, a theology of why, you know, bad things happen. The only theodicy the Bible gives you isn't about origins. It's just about it exists. Mm-hmm. Get in there and revolt, like rail, rage, protest, activism, prophecy. I mean, just get after it, revolt. And there's something about the progressive mind that I want to tap into, because I do think that progressives are a people of revolt. Like, if anybody's passionate about revolting against suffering, I think, I'm not saying about conservatism, but lots of progressives are really concerned about social justice and suffering, and so they're oriented toward revolt. And yet the very thing that motivates the revolt undermines their faith, because it's the problem at the root of often the progressive kind of theological world, the problem of suffering. And I want to try to do some work and say, is there some way we can kind of harness that together and say that we can turn the problem of evil and shift away from being a problem and just use it to energize progressives, because it's very kind of alternatingly energizing and de-energizing. So we're often in mixed minds. We want to wrestle against evil, but yet evil is what causes us to lose faith.
Yeah.
And so I think progressives are stuck. So hence my journey to try to figure out a way to kind of solve that, square that circle. I don't know. And my argument is one way to do that is kind of just embrace the weakness of God. If God is the weak force of love in the world, then evil is always going to be kind of an intrusive force. And love is always going to have to be an interruptive force to evil in the world. But that creates its own theological problems.
We'll put a pin in the weakness of God and we'll come back to that.
Okay.
Because you can't just say God is weak and just leave it there. There's plenty of follow-up questions.
All right. Yeah, that's a big question.
Pin in that one. Okay, so let's go back to warfare theology.
Right.
So that basically assumes evil is just there. We're going to deal with it. And we're going to revolt against evil.
Yeah.
Okay, we're all on board with that. But it doesn't deal with the question of where does it come from.
Exactly.
And so you replace the question of why is there to how did it get here.
Mm-hmm.
And so it seems like you kind of teeter on dualism at that point, where it's just, okay, God's here, evil's here, God's not in control of it. And so it seems, is it more of, like, warfare theology, is it more of an attempt to deal with the mental issue of how can there be a good, loving God and let evil happen? Is that where it's coming from, you think?
Well, I think, you know, Greg, in his book, his argument is that, you know, the way he deals with the dualism is that evil is produced by, you know, the free will of angelic creatures and human creatures. And that's the way he gets around that.
But you don't buy into that as much.
Yeah, so that's
your move to...
That's another pinch.
The weakness of God, Caputo, which it's nice of you to be able to deal with Caputo stuff since he's best friends with your nemesis Pete Rollins.
Peter Rollins is not my nemesis.
Okay, so it's nice of you to be able to use his work, even though there's obviously gang allegiances that are being
That's
broken.
Right. You know, yeah. I am... I'll play ball with just about anybody if I find him useful.
Okay,
you know?
So the free will thing doesn't do it for you. You don't think that that's good enough example? Or doesn't meet some sort of mental...
Yeah, mandate. Well, so... So that's you know that goes back to another example of kind of the way I do theology is that free will is a contested view, and so I often get dinged by people by saying I reject free will. No, I don't reject free will. What I have problems about it is how much weight it carries for lots of theological systems. And so, for example, in this case for Greg, you know, free will carries a lot of weight to make this theology work, you know, the free will of agents. Well, but free will is just very controversial. Lots of people don't know if it's even a coherent concept. And so you're putting a lot of theological weight on an anthropological concept.
You okay, know. Hold on. Your next. Are you one of those people that doesn't think it really can carry that much weight?
It could. I mean, here's the thing. It can if it exists. It can carry that
weight.
Do you
think it exists?
I don't know. That's what I'm saying is I'm agnostic about it.
But are you... Dang. I need to start. I don't know. I'm agnostic about.
Well,
taxes.
Let me say it this way. I think. Let me come back. Let me phrase it this way. I think it's backwards because free will is the claim about human agents. Okay. I think it's backwards to do theology by making claims about what people are like. So I just don't think it is a good move. I think you should articulate what God is like, and humans can be however humans are going to be. But to me, I just don't like the free will arguments a lot because it tends to lead with the anthropology. Humans have to be a certain way. And if humans are that certain way, then we get all these great theological benefits. And my argument is that that puts a lot of pressure on psychology and biology because humans have to work out a certain way. You know, I mean, and if they don't, if the evidence or the psychological or the neuroscientific evidence starts mm-hmm. shifting us away, then... I mean, it's, you know, in some far future, what if free will comes under assault because of advanced science? Now, all this theology we built on top of this human construct is now threatened by an advance in science. And we've been down this road before.
Now, you might be in this camp, but it seems like there's a viewpoint in the social science world that believes in determinism, that you don't really make as many choices as you think. And do you think that is that the kind of science that undoes the theology of free will?
Well, it can, but again, I like to just step away from free will because I don't even know if that's coherent. What I believe in, you know, I don't know what it means to be free. What do we mean by free? Because if you mean causally unconstrained, then I don't know if that's coherent, you know, that there's no causal precursor. That's almost a godlike capacity. I don't even know if that is psychologically coherent. Like if everything that is flowing into my present currently, if somehow I can radically break with that, you know, I don't even know. That seems to be a recipe for schizophrenia, you know, that.
I just want to say I have the choice to not go rob a bank?
I think there are choices there. So, again, that's what people hear. They say if there's no free will, there's no choices. Of course we make choices. The issue for me isn't necessarily whether or not the will is free or determined. But what I talk about on the blog I've written about, what I call weak or strong volitionists. Volition is the word for will in psychology. And so instead of talking about determinism and free will, which gets us into really – we get stuck either way. I like this – my issue is how much capacity does the will have for change? So I describe myself not as a determinist but somebody that believes in a weak volition, that the will has a range of powers – but that change is hard, addictions can happen, habits are difficult to acquire, and change is slow, and not always, but it is. And the only reason I care about this has nothing to do with spiritual warfare, but it's all about my concern that if the will is sluggish and slow, at least for some people, and that might be even due to environment and heredity, you might be raised, you know, in a Muslim family, or you might be abused by a priest, or you might, I mean, things shape us in deep ways that can take lifetimes to process. And if somebody somehow doesn't accept Jesus as their Lord and Savior before their death, and they're working through some things, what happens to them? That is the question that kind of created a faith crisis for me in college.
Really?
Yeah. And now you can get around all that if you believe in free will, right? You just,
they had a choice.
Yeah, you just have it. They had a choice and they didn't make it. But yeah, it's not that I'm not saying that those backgrounds and those life histories determined. It's just that I think it takes some time to process those things. And if we, lots of us, to complete our faith journey with some degree of integrity, are going to need more time than the time that life allots us, particularly if death is a random event. You know, we can die suddenly and accidentally. And so those were all the things that created the pressures that ultimately ended up kind of my stuff that I've written about, mm-hmm. universal reconciliation. You're just going to have to, the only way you can address those problems is eschatologically. You're going to have to extend, if God needs time, you're going to have to extend your biography with God past death, to give people the time.
And don't you read the Paul stuff about the sting of death is its finality, like that it's over, and that, your argument is that the sting of death, its finality has been removed, and so there's enough time for it to be worked out.
So I argue the defeat of death is that the kind of stopwatch of death has been defeated, and that God has all the time in the world now with us.
So all this to say, you think Boyd's wrong about free will. So that's a yes.
I'm just agnostic about it.
Okay, yeah. But your move is the weakness of God.
Right, so the reason why evil seems to be, again, if we're going to be agnostic about origins, then why is evil? Why is there evil? And the answer is because God's not going to knock heads together, and so if rather than evil existing because of free will. I start with that's anthropology. Start with free will. I say let's make a claim about God and see if that can explain why evil. And so the answer there is if God is weakness, that's Caputo's argument. Then evil will break into the world fairly regularly because it's a violent, coercive power force, and that love is always going to therefore be coming from the bottom up and intruding into a world. And so evil exists because God is the weak force of love in the world. Now, the pressure there is, there's other questions there about God's omnipotence then.
Mm-hmm.
But either way, this is the point I make, either way, you're limiting God's omnipotence. In Boyd's view, it's limited because of the free will of human agents. God is somehow cannot know. Maybe it's God's omniscience. But there is some limitation of some sort. So he's limiting the omniscience of God because of free will. And I'm toggling with this idea of what the power of God looks like. What does it mean to say God is all powerful if God is love? That's a difficult question, but that's what I was trying to wrestle with.
Yeah. So let's circle back. The heart of your work on progressives, warfare, spirituality is, one of the benefits of that is that you think it reclaims the understanding of sin.
Yeah.
And so can you kind of flesh that out a little bit?
Well, I think progressives, because a lot of progressives, and by progressive, we're kind of talking about post-evangelicals, have had such a toxic relationship with the sin word, because that's kind of the dominant impulse in conservative circles, sin, guilt, and therefore the, substitutionary atoning blood sacrifice of Jesus to deal with that sin, that they've been so brutalized by the shame and the guilt of that background that they have shifted to justice as their focal point. And so, it's classically progressives focus on social justice and conservatives focus on sin. But I think what has happened is both groups have kind of thrown out something important. Conservatives obviously lose this systemic evil focus, but progressives, I think, by focusing on the systemic evil, have lost the part that Wink is trying to point us to, which is the spirituality, that our battle against the principalities is not against flesh and blood. And I think that's the temptation of progressive spirituality, is that in the pursuit of justice, you can become more and more violent, more and more angry at human beings. And so we have to attend to the way which even oppressors are caught up by the powers. And they have been sucked up into these cultures, and that we're trying to liberate. So in liberation theology, you're not just trying to liberate the victims, but also the oppressor. So when King talks about the nonviolent force of love, it's not just to liberate, you know, the marginalized and the oppressed. It's also to liberate the oppressor, because that person is in spiritual bondage as well. And I also think we need to recover spirituality for progressives, because in your battles in justice, progressives are often really prone to burnout and cynicism. And so unless Thomas Merton talked a lot about this, the contemplative side of activism, if there's not a contemplative side of activism, you're just going to get burnt out. Mm-hmm. Or you're going to think you're going to get angry and cynical because you're the Messiah figure that's going to fix the world. And you're either going to be tempted by power to make that happen, or you're going to burn yourself out and just be real bitter that the systems don't change you know, as quickly as you want them to. All that to say is, I think by failing to attend to sin, the way even the pursuit of justice can be tainted by sin. And so this is where somebody like a Niebuhr is really powerful about how sin can kind of contaminates all of our attempts to fight it. Even the fight against sin is contaminated by sin in many ways.
Yeah. So what is the way that we look at sin if it's not going to just be the substitutionary atonement? You know, you sin, you should feel guilty about this. Jesus is the way to placate that guilt. How are we seeing it then?
Well, I think you look at it in a Christus Victor frame, where sin is not like a bad thing I did, but it's a power. Mm-hmm. So you look at that in the way Paul talked about it, is he often talked about sin not necessarily as a, you know, I masturbated, now far I feel guilty, so I did this bad thing. Sin in conservative minds is often like hedonic, you know, excess. You know, I succumb to lust, or I succumb to greed, or I eat too much. And so it's all about our pleasures. And I think that's the thin view of sin that conservatives have. But Paul often talked about it as like a force, like a sin is this thing that's outside us. Like that classic example in the Old Testament where it says, what is that story where it says sin is lurking at the door, ready to, you know.
Drag you, ready to entice you, yeah.
Yeah, it's this force out there. And that's where I think Wink's stuff is helpful, because you see sin as this thing that captures us. And what we need is emancipation from those structures or those spiritual dynamics. And so now here we see God rescuing us from sin, mm-hmm. the power of sin, the allure of it, the siren's wail. And now the sin isn't necessarily me being a bad person. And so you don't need to go into the penal substitutionary atonement in that view.
What if I feel guilty because, let's go with the drinking analogy. So okay. I feel guilty because I drank too much again, and now I feel ashamed about it, and so I want to go back and drink again tonight. And I want to get rid of this guilt, but there's a better way to see that as like this roaring lion that's going to come and attack me.
Right, right.
How am I processing this in this view of sin?
Well, let me say this. I don't think – okay, I have issues with penal substitutionary atonement. I don't have issues with guilt. Okay.
And the issue is the way it presents God.
Yeah, wrathful God, right? That God
God is the
God requires a blood sacrifice.
Big brother is back home from college, right. And he's going to protect us from dad, who's going to beat us up.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
But I do think human guilt – first of all, I think guilt's a good thing. It can get – again, for this is where I'm going to start rubbing against – progressives, because again, guilt has been such a toxic thing. But we need some capacity for shame and guilt, because it helps us feel, you know, and Brené Brown talks about this in her work, Daring Greatly. She makes the distinction between guilt and shame. So shame is, well, guilt is I did something wrong.
Yeah.
And shame is I am, you know, I did something bad versus I am bad. So guilt is good. It's causal. I take responsibility for what I did. The laying shame on top of the guilt is probably, you know, pretty toxic. But what I'm saying is those are helpful moral emotions.
It's good that I feel guilty about drinking in excess.
Yeah. And I do think there's something about the atoning death of Jesus that suggests that there is no guilt, that our guilt does have somehow an answer in the cross. The mechanism there, again, we can get into. But I do think progressives have tended to kind of blow past some of the good things in kind of some of the conservative churches. I do think guilt is a problem. Lots of people feel extraordinarily guilty when they come in. And the message of grace is powerful and transformative. And so when people come in and they've made a mess of their lives and they've ruined their lives and they've sinned, they do need to hear grace and grace. And I don't think progressives have a problem with that, but if you're giving that message, then what are you addressing? You're addressing this fundamental sense of I'm a guilty human being or a sinner. You know, how we get the grace, is it because of the atoning blood of Jesus? I mean, that's an issue we could talk about. But I do think progressives need to say people come in with guilt and they need to deal with that as much as they need to fight for justice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that sin is huge and multifaceted and very complex. And again, thus a need for spiritual, a kind of a vision of spiritual warfare, because it's not just about fighting. I mean, think about it, right? You want to fight sex trafficking. That's a systemic oppression, but you're not going to address lust. You know, you're going to have to address lust at some level. And that brings us kind of squarely back to, you know, kind of where the conservatives do real good ranting about lust. It's both and.
Do you think progressives just didn't want to deal with guilt? And so there's a tendency just to get rid of it altogether and just jump right into the societal structures that are.
Yeah. I think we've swung, right? I think it's we've swung too far. We kind of came out of churches that basically focused on piety and therefore preached a lot of guilt and shame. And I think they did that because rhetorically, that's how you get a response to the gospel.
It works well, yeah.
Yeah, it's extremely powerful, but that really poisoned a lot of people's self concepts and so when they kind of broke free from that. And there's a lot of that. I mean, if you just kind of, there's all sorts of blogs devoted to kind of the post-evangelical, post-fundamentalist getting in the clear, and so then you read some of like me saying, "Hey, guilt is good," and you know we probably need some of that stuff.
That's
and,
the title, "Guilt
and,
is Good,"
and you know let's go back in hearing sermons about lust again, and then you're like, "Well, I'm kind of back in," that was real toxic for me, and I don't want to go back in that direction. So I do think there's a timing in life kind of thing. I think if you just come out of that stuff, then what I'm saying is probably not, you know, going to be all that helpful because you're working through some wounds. But I do think that this is, and this other people have talked about this as well, I do think one of the problems of progressive Christianity is it's the shadow to the evangelical sun. Like everything is reacting to what evangelical, you know, so it's almost defined as being against, you know, whatever evangelicalism or fundamentalism represented. And so it's a very reactive, thus the constant paying attention to what they are doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how much of the progressive blog world is focused on the behavior of evangelicals? I mean, we just cannot take our eyes off them. We are fixated on them. And I think it's because we're still not at a peaceable place with the past. And until we get there, I don't think what I'm talking about is going to resonate real well.
What do you think it's going to take for us to get there?
I mean, I think it's an individual journey. I think at some point you're going to have to reconcile with the past. I think at some point when you heal the wounds of the past, then your fascination with that culture wanes. And you're just like, whatever. I mean, you know, I mean, they're going to do what they're going to do, but not paying attention to what they're doing so much mm-hmm. in their churches. Now, I don't want to paint with too broad a brush. I mean, I think if there's a very toxic thing going on in a very prominent, you know, evangelical community that's hurting people, women, or marginalized populations, that we shouldn't speak out against that. So it's not, I'm not saying we should never do that. I'm saying that there is kind of a fixation that could be unhealthy with what's going on in their churches. So you don't want to create a faith that it's about, you don't want to create a spirituality that's about the faith of other people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you always want to kind of look in the mirror.
One of the things you've also talked about is that the message that, you know, progressive often have doesn't really work well with the average person who's showing up at church, and more so the lower socioeconomic class, that they just don't connect as much with kind of the progressive message. And so you think the spiritual warfare language would actually be more receptive, or they'd be more receptive to that message?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that's the impetus for my own interest in
this. Did it come out of like a lot of the communities you're involved in, obviously, you know, prison ministry and some mm-hmm. stuff at your church as well?
Yeah, so I started teaching a Bible study out of prison, and then I started worshiping and doing life together with a small church plant that reaches out to kind of homeless and marginalized people. And when in both of those locations, just very kind of a charismatic sensibility. And I think that is characterized by many populations, marginalized populations, like the third world, Pentecostalism and charismatic spirituality thrive in those poor, mm-hmm. poor context. And so I'm hearing language about the spirit and spiritual affliction and demons and Satan and that kind of thing. And as a really rationalistic, kind of cynical, disenchanted, progressive academic person, I just was just out of my league. And so I wanted to somehow communicate and speak the language in those locations, but I needed to do it with integrity. You know, I just didn't want to talk about the devil and or the demonic or spiritual battles of the spirit without getting clear in my own head what I mean by that and speak it with integrity. So we might have very different, the guys out of the prison and myself might have very different ideas about what we mean by the language of spiritual warfare, but there's enough similarities that we can speak about this. We're naming the same phenomena in the world, and I'm speaking that language with integrity. So I had to do it. I had to kind of think about the spiritual warfare thing because I was just talking about it more, and I didn't want to just use words and that were hollow. And so that began that kind of process.
And it doesn't seem hollow if you're using spiritual warfare language, and one person might be more Boydian with a literal interpretation, and one might be more Winkish.
Yeah, have a Winkian theology.
So you think we can swim together?
Well, I would like to think that. I don't think that's that unusual, though. I think when people use lots of different religious language, they have very different understandings. I mean, I think if you unpack the theology of any given church on a Sunday morning, people will be all over the map. So I hope so. This is the way I talk about it. I say, listen, you know, descriptively, and I'd say something like with Greg Boyd, I'd say this. I'd say descriptively, when we are looking at something, we can describe it in exactly the same way. We can describe the behaviors, the psychology, the experiences, and some of the description might feel like they experience feeling possessed of a devil. I mean, that's descriptively the words we're grabbing for. I mean, we can agree on what is happening right in front of us. We might disagree on explanatory models, why it's happening, and you might appeal to, you know, a little personified devil, and I might say, you know, it's a psychosomatic, you know, thing or whatever, but we can agree on what's happening in front of us. And so that's the way I kind of come at this. I say we're going to agree on what's happening. Why it's happening, we might disagree. On those kinds of things.
Yeah. Well, I knew we were going to talk about this, so I went back yesterday, the day before, and read through some of your posts on the subject, which was, I guess you posted it 2013, June, which in your mildly obsessive writing schedule means you probably wrote it in 2006.
That's right.
Yeah, so you wrote it 8 years before. But one of the things I saw in there is you linked to your Christian Scholar Conference paper that you presented last year. Do you remember the title for that?
I do. Can we say it online?
Well, you can. I'm not going to say it because my mom might listen.
Is that right? Yeah. So my title for the Christian Scholars Conference. Well, this was
you wanted it to be.
Yeah, and they edited it. It was called, the submitted title was On Anarchism and Assholes.
Okay. And you ended that paper with a line, in the kingdom of heaven there will be no
assholes.
Now, it's funny you mention that because a few weeks ago we had Nadia Bowles Weber on.
Yeah.
And you know what she called you?
I listened to the podcast.
And she called you
called me an asshole.
Yeah. So do you think that's an example of karma? And do you feel creates cognitive dissonance because maybe that means you're not going to be in heaven?
Oh, that's true. I guess that,
because the kingdom of heaven, there's not going to be those.
That's, yeah, so I'm going to have to repent, for the kingdom of God is at hand, you know? So I still have time. Remember?
Yeah.
The will is sluggish and slow. So you know, I'll either work through this sanctification project before death or afterwards.
Well,
so there's hope.
And your eschatology, you got plenty of time.
I got so much time. I got all the time in the world.
All the time and beyond
the
world.
All the love that God will give me to save me or whatever like that.
Well, I also know beforehand you're upset that you are not beating Storm in the total number of appearances on the show.
Yeah, that's true. Hey, we need to come back to why, like I need to, like, Nadia Bowles Weber doesn't necessarily think I'm an asshole. I just wrote. I don't know her. I'm going to see her. I think I'm going to meet her at
you're doing a conference in Phoenix.
Yeah, but I don't think she's going to that. But she's going to. I've heard.
Yes, she is going
to
be at Pepperdine.
She's going to be at Pepperdine, and so my hope is to get to meet her there, and we'll compare tattoos.
Yeah, you guys are both tall, cursing, tattooed,
and she is the inspiration for my tattoo.
Seriously?
Well,
is it a picture of Nadia? That'd be kind of awkward for me.
That's going to be awkward when I ask her to sign my tattoo. Nadia, would you sign my tattoo?
How did she inspire your tattoo?
Well, so I'd always wanted it. She has her tattoos are liturgical mm-hmm. icons, and that just got in the back of my head. And then when the Rublev icon of the hospitality of Abraham became such a huge part of my spiritual practice, I thought I'd get it because of what I'd seen with her. I thought I should. Mm-hmm. get a tattoo. So that's what my tattoo is of an icon. And it was like, because I'd seen...
You saw Nadia do it.
I saw that a couple years ago. This is before her book came out. And mm-hmm. I just was, that was always rattling around the back of my head. So I owe my ink to hers.
Wow, that must have really stung when she called you that then. I mean, she's like a hero for you.
That's true. I'm working through it, right? But not everybody likes me. Yeah, and right. I'm working through that.
You know, let me tell you something. I went and preached at a church when I was like a senior. And I pole vaulted ACU for a little while until I realized I'm not good enough to pole vault with these people. And my coach was at the church on the Wednesday night. And he walks up to me after I'm done preaching. And he walks up to me and goes, Luke, it's a good thing you're a better preacher than you were pole vaulter. And I was like, is that a compliment or a criticism? I don't know. I don't know what that means. So,
I didn't know you were pole vaulter.
Well, I didn't win a national championship, and if you don't win one of those at ACU, then you're pretty much
that's true. Useless. We have a good track team.
Between me and the three of the other pole vaulters that I vaulted with, there was like six national championships, one Canadian championship, and then nothing that I offered. But those are all from everyone else.
Here's the thing. Let me ask you this question: How did it seems like to me, one doesn't just start day one of pole vaulting on the big pole. Like, do they start you off with little tiny poles?
Yeah. Actually, the first day.
Is that pretty embarrassing? You're jumping over like a 5-foot thing with like a...
It's a broom. Actually, the first day of practice in high school, the coach drug the mats over behind the stadium bleachers and said, fall off backwards. And that was the first thing.
There you go.
If you're dumb enough to do this, you can do that. And then you start actually with... you have training poles which don't bend, and so you're just working with basic form, and then you start with a 13-foot pole and 14 and 15 and 16 and all that stuff.
There you go.
And I know a lot of people have just checked out right now. Like, I did not want to hear about pole vaulting.
Yeah, well, you never know where these podcasts are going to go.
Exactly. Hey, thanks for your time, Richard.
Appreciate it.
Hey, this is the first one we did live and in person.
I think so.
Yeah.
Yes.
Which means the first time I interviewed you with pants on.
That's awkward.
Perfect. Thanks for checking out Newsworthy with Norsworthy. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You are now adjourned.